Oldie Literary Lunch Recordings presents Ferdinand Mount, The Tears of Araj, Mutiny, Money and Marriage in India, 1805 to 1905, sponsored by Noble Caledonia.
Greenside, yes. I did once see Laurie Lee, who was pointed out to me coming out of a pub in the Fulham Road. He was coming out of a pub in the Fulham Road, and he looked like somebody who had had a good life, and now I know that he did. Well, we've had the romantic and musical beginning, and we're going to have the funny and comical end, and I was a bit unclear about how to fill the bit in the middle. I know that the reduced Shakespeare company managed to reduce the Bard's entire works into 10 or 15 minutes, but I wasn't sure that I could manage that with the entire history of the British in India. And as you'll see, if you see my book outside, I miserably failed with the book, which is three times the size of Valerie's and Helen's put together, and you'll need a taxi to take it home. So what I think I'll do instead is tell you a little bit about what my great-grandfather, Malcolm Lowe, did in the mutiny, because he's only a bit part player, and so it's quite a short story, but it's a violent one. So this is the bloodthirsty section of the afternoon. Malcolm Lowe was born in the residency at Lucknow, where his father, John Lowe, had been resident, and he was christened in the little gothic-y church in the ground, which was reduced to ruins about 3 foot high during the Great Rebellion of 1857, or the Mutiny. Even today, in its poignant ruined state, as I'm sure some of you know, probably been there, it's the residency is a delightful spot. It looks like a really nice villa in Tunbridge Wells, which might have been designed by Decimus Burton. But little Malcolm wasn't destined to enjoy it for long. At the age of 18 months, he was sent to, in quotes, home in Scotland, where the Lowes came from, in Fifeshire. And his parents, John and Augusta, were all alone in the residency. They'd had two daughters who died in infancy, and a third daughter, Charlotte, they'd sent home even earlier, at the age of 8 months, never to see her for the next 15 years, as they didn't see Malcolm. The horrors of that separation haunts old memories of India. However, he survived to follow the usual flight path of children of the Raj, coming back to India at the age of 17 to join the Indian Civil Service. And here we find him, a winning young man with a curly moustache and a nice smile, in charge of collecting the revenue at Meerut, which is where the Great Mutiny broke out, north of Delhi. And if he'd been there, if Malcolm had been there at the time, he would no doubt have been murdered in his bungalow, like half his colleagues. But one of the things that my low ancestors had was a great knack of being absent during massacres. So he was up in the hills, recovering from a sick bug, immediately cancelled his leave, cantered back down the pass to the plains. The first town he came to, the hard-drinking magistrate, Mr. Robert Spankey, sent him straight back up to the hills again with an elephant with all the treasure of Saharanpur, which is the name of the station. And so you get this extraordinary thing: within a month of the mutiny breaking out, these hill stations, Mussoorie, which coincidentally is where Malcolm's parents had been married, was filled with wives and children who'd been sent up there to escape the violence. It was also filled with treasure chests, which the British had sent up to the hills to avoid the mutineers, because the first thing you need to get a good rebellion going is rupees, and they knew where to get them. So you get this sense during the mutiny that the hill stations, which had only been going for 20 years, had become a refuge for the British, not just from the cruel climate, but from the people they were supposed to be ruling. Anyway, Malcolm comes back down again, and Mr. Spankey sends him straight out to collect the revenue, because they've sent all the rupees up to the hills, and they've got nothing left to pay the staff. This was the most ticklish task you could have in northern India, because out in the sticks, the local rebels were killing revenue officers first, being more aggrieved by the harsh tax assessments than by the more famous cause of the mutiny, which was the precise makeup of the grease used in the cartridges for the new Enfield rifles. And this wasn't just a revolt of disaffected sepoys. The entire country was up in arms. Roderick Edwards, the feisty new magistrate at Musavanagar, wrote in his diary, "No sooner do we suppress them in one place than they appear in another some 20 miles away, like wildfowl ducking under the water and then popping up again at the other end of the lake." So Malcolm was now civil servant, most peaceable sort of fellow. He had a sabre in one hand and a pistol in the other. And he wrote with youthful panache and perhaps some naivete to his parents, who were now in Calcutta, to give them what he called an unvarnished statement of his exploits. He and Mr. Edwards galloped from one village to the next with a small force of Punjabis and Gurkhas. At one village, Herhar, the stir and commotion inside the village was plainly discernible, Malcolm said, but not a shot was fired by the villagers. They had by this time seen the company of Gurkhas advancing and deemed resistance useless. How often the British would have cause to be grateful for the loyalty of the Gurkhas in those desperate days and ever since. And this is, as you probably know, the 200th anniversary of their joining forces with the British. They saved Malcolm's bacon. Malcolm then tells John and Augusta that they entered the village and plundered it, and he adds, "The ringleaders were put to death and many others flogged at the cart's tail." Then he sits down to breakfast under a tree. But then there's news of another outbreak at a place called Jaula. "We charged accordingly, and a fine sight it was. The rebel infantry stood, but almost all their cavalry bolted. The result was that they were thoroughly beaten and dispersed. Upwards of 100 dead bodies were left on the field, while we lost but 9 killed and wounded. All the great men of the town were captured and hung." He underlines all. "What would burn was then set on fire." And he ends with a self-congratulatory note. "We left Jaula in a fearfully different state from what it had been in the morning." Now, if you read Mr. Edwards' official reports to the government in Calcutta, of which there were 3, you won't find a word about the plunder and the flogging and the hanging and the burning. Some of it would these days be regarded as a war crime, I suppose, but even then it was best left in decent obscurity. And I've always wondered whether Malcolm ever regretted sending his unvarnished account to his parents. Sometimes he and Mr. Edwards found that the birds had already flown, or that the forces arrayed against them were too strong. A town called Tana Bawan had become a mecca for what Malcolm called fanatic Muslims, or Ghazis, as they were also called, and as we would now say, jihadis. By some accounts, the place had become a small theocracy. These zealots fought like tigers, and Malcolm and his cavalry had to retreat in confusion, slashing as they went, Malcolm himself being salami sliced, his solar topi split in half. If he had but known it, this was probably the first major encounter between the British and the small number of jihadis who took part in the mutiny. 3 of the young zealots who repelled Malcolm in that engagement then escaped to a nearby town called Deoband, which you may have heard of, where they founded the strict school of Islam that later spread over half the Muslim world. And it is Deobandis today who provide the theological underpinning for the Taliban and who inspire the overwhelming majority of madrasas in Pakistan and quite a few in Britain too. And then there's one final engagement. Even a year later, when the mutiny had been suppressed almost everywhere else and people were congratulating each other both in Calcutta and London, up near the border with Nepal, Malcolm was still trying to rally a scratch force of policemen and road menders against the 12,000 troops of the local warlord. He was eventually reinforced by a detachment of cavalry under his brother-in-law's uncle, Captain Samuel Brown. Everyone was related to each other in the small British community. And in a Homeric hand-to-hand combat, a sepoy slashed off Brown's left arm. According to Captain Brown, later general, when at his death, in his obit in the Times, years later, the next instant Mr. Lowe had killed the sepoy. Fortunately, Mr. Lowe had a tourniquet in his pocket, which he promptly applied to the injured limb and to stop the bleeding and saved Brown's life. With exemplary honesty, which I like to think is characteristic of our family, Malcolm, by then long returned home, wrote in from 22 Rowland Gardens, South Kensington, where he lived, to say that he had no consciousness at all of having grappled with Sam's assailant, and even less that he had anything to do with the tourniquet, which had been supplied by the surgeon who was riding hard on their heels. But this little incident achieved immortality, and not just because Sam won the VC for it. His lost arm, in fact, was to become the most famous missing limb in military history after Nelson's. Desperate to continue his military career, he had his saddler design for him a special leather belt with an extra strap passing diagonally over the right shoulder to stop the scabbard from sliding around and to keep the pistol pouch steady. And this turned out to be extremely handy for officers with two arms as well. And so the Sam Brown belt was born. And my great-grandfather's career as a military man was brief and unsought. In later life, he never talked of his experiences. He told my grandmother they were too painful to recall. And my father remembered him as a sweet old gentleman who was rather frightened of his well-born wife. But Malcolm was in at the beginning of three things which were to become so familiar to us over the next century and a half. The Gurkhas coming to the aid of the British, the jihadi warriors coming out of the dust, and the Sam Brown belt. Thank you very much.
The Oldie Magazine recordings. Noble Caledonia, proud sponsors of the Oldie Literary Lunches. This is a Radio Gorgeous production for the Oldie 2015.